I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, Nightlife Legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined by my co-host, the co-founder of World of Wonder, Randy Barbato. Fenton Bailey is off on secret assignment. He will join us again next week. Our guest today is a fashion icon. She is a store owner, a stylist, a fashion designer. You might know her work from Sex and the City, Devil Wears Prada, Ugly Betty, Emily in Paris. She is the father of the House of Fields. She is the author of a new memoir, Pat in the City, My Life in Fashion, Style, and Breaking All the Rules. She's also the subject of a new documentary premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival, Happy Clothes. Congratulations on that. Welcome to the show, Patricia Fields. Bah!
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be with you, former New Yorkers, again. I have to say I miss you.
I think we're always New Yorkers, though.
And by the way, like, you know, we're in L.A., you're in New York, but your presence is very much felt here on the West Coast. Wouldn't you say, James?
I would. The Patricia Fields look, it's worldwide now. It used to be on 8th Street, and now it's the entire world.
I have to come out there one of these days.
You know, I think of you as a hurricane who just keeps gathering strength and speed the longer you're around. Life is pretty good for you right now, isn't it?
It is. It's very good. I love when I moved into this neighborhood. I believe I had sold my Bowery store. I was looking for something that was, you know, not quite so much pressure buying trips and whatever, because I had so many talented fashion people around me, designers and so on. So I thought, I'm going to open up a little gallery around the corner from where I live. And these different fashion favorites of mine, I invited them to come and, you know, be in the gallery. And it's been a couple of years now that we have this gallery, I think. It's been more than maybe than a couple of years. It's good. I'm happy with it. It's really good for me in as much as I am not like obligated to go here and there on buying trips and so on. You know, it's like a little more toned down, but, you know, still very exciting for me.
I love Dope Tavio. He is one. I'm wearing Dope Tavio to DragCon, Randy, both days. I'm so excited. He's one of my favorite finds of yours.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You know, he's in Miami now, right?
Yeah, he's a cutie, isn't he?
Yes, I love him. He's a sweetheart and very, very talented.
Randy, do you remember the first time you went to Patricia Fields' store on 8th Street? Do you remember you and Fenton going?
Yeah, I remember. Like, I don't remember the date. I just remember the experience of it. And it was an experiential thing, unlike anything else, really. I also remember not having a penny to my name. So it was more, for me, it was like a visual extravaganza versus a major shopping spree.
Well, I'm only sorry that you're no longer here now that you have a little cash in your pocket.
I remember I was living in the dorms on Fifth Avenue at NYU, and Lisa Edelstein and I dressed up like we were going to Aria. We were so intimidated because we kept hearing the stories about how scary the staff was. I mean, it was a big deal. And we got there, and Richard Alvarez, I think, was working at the time. And he was so adorable and so sweet. He had the broken glasses. He was hysterical. It was a fabulous experience. And he just took us around and showed us everything. And we were not scared at all to ever go back.
Oh, I know Richard is a case unto himself. I have a beautiful artwork of his in my apartment here, and I treasure it. We're still very much in touch. He's good. You can see some archive footage of 8th Street in my documentary. I don't know if that's important to you.
No, yeah, no,
we're
definitely.
Just letting you know. Let's do an opening in L.A.
We have, I mean, we have a space here. It might not be quite glamorous enough for you.
Oh, I'm not glamorous. I'm just, I'm not efficient. I'm not glamorous. I'm creative.
So you were born in New York and then raised in Queens.
I was born in Manhattan. And when I was about, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, 10 years old, I'll say. I can't remember. We moved out to Queens.
Your mom had a dry cleaning business that she expanded. So clothes were always in your DNA. You were always around clothes, even when you were a child.
Yes. And we lived, when it all started, I lived two blocks away from where my mom's dry cleaning place was. So, you know, and I went to school right across the street from where we live. So I kind of grew up on the East Side in the 70s.
You talk in your book about how in, I guess it would be the late 50s, early 60s, you were in high school and you would go down to the Village and you would go to like the Village Vanguard and Five Spot Cafe, you mentioned. Tell me about like the people you would see, the stars you would see in performing.
I loved the Village. I used to, in the daytime, we were on 8th Street shopping. In the nighttime, Village Vanguard, Five Spot. Different, because at that time, also jazz was big. I remember like two high school friends of mine, the mother of one of these friends had a radio show that she broadcasted out of Harlem. So on the weekends, we go up to Harlem. One time her guest was Billie Holiday. I was like, I was sitting on the floor at her feet. It was unbelievable. I could never forget that. I was really into the jazz music.
Was the Village Vanguard a small club? So if you saw Sarah Vaughan there, you were right there on top of her, right? I mean, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge big club. It was, you know, a relatively medium-sized small club for jazz enthusiasts.
You opened your first store on Washington Place.
Oh, Washington Place, yes.
Yeah. And that was with your partner, Joanne. And this was 1966, right?
Yes. We put this little store together. I felt very confident in choosing the location because I went to NYU. And I kind of understood, you know, the girls would be going back and forth from building to building and passing right back by my store to be. The main reason that I chose that location, because I could afford it, because it was a little off the main drag. And that was the beginning.
What was it you sold mostly, like jeans or what it was called, the pants pub?
Yeah, it wasn't so much jeans as it was like, at that point, the pants silhouettes were inspired by menswear.
Mm.
And it was more slim. The fabrics were a little more tailored. You know, it was new. It was sexy. The gals loved it. I knew it because I loved it. I was able to bring it out and show it, my ideas to people.
When you were at NYU, what were you studying?
I went in because in high school I studied languages because I knew languages from my childhood, from my Greek grandmother mainly. And but languages were easy for me. So I said, oh, I'm going to, you know, easy breezy, I'm going to major in languages. But then when I got to NYU, I was introduced to other subject matters that I didn't really, you know, I didn't have any experience. It was new to me. And I was attracted to it. For example, philosophy, loved it. I don't know, maybe because I'm Greek and I'm a natural philosopher. Who the hell knows? But college offered me subject matter that I, you know, I wasn't exposed to before. I appreciated it, I got into it. But when I went in there, with no real idea, but through my studies, I didn't still take with me how to bring my education into my adulthood. But it was like, maybe it was my mom's dry cleaning. I'd be in there with her and she'd tell me, oh, this is Silk and this is that. And it was, you know, a pretty nice neighborhood. And I wanted her to buy us a brownstone, but she told me we couldn't afford it. So in the end, we moved out to Whitestone, Queens, which was okay, but it wasn't Manhattan after all.
But you were working all through college as a buyer, right? I mean, you're working at a department store so that you were getting your, both with fashion and business, you were sort of getting your feet wet a little before.
Yeah, but I didn't do that while I was in college.
Mm.
I didn't really work when I was in college. I just used to drive my T-Bird from Queens to NYU downtown. But I have to say, college opened up a whole new world to me that was inspiring, educational, of course, but, you know, opened up the world out there to me. And I really did appreciate that.
Yeah.
And so I opened up my store on NYU's campus, and that's my first store.
What was the move to 8th Street and the decision to call it Pat Fields, and why do that move?
Why do that move? Because 8th Street was just like two short blocks away. And I wanted to go where the action was, because when I was in high school, we'd always go down to the Village to 8th Street shopping for or do our shopping. So I knew it. But at that point, I guess I felt, okay, I'm going to give it a go. I think I could afford it because I had about a year or two. My NYU location, but NYU is right around the corner from 8th Street. And also, NYU owned that property. They owned both of the properties. And back in the day, people that ran the real estate department were staffers of NYU. They were part of the university. You know, it changed since then. It became more corporate and so on. But the real estate department would come by the store because their offices were, you know, right near there. And, you know, we'd go for lunch and say hi. And we had a relationship that it doesn't really exist anymore. Not for me, but in the world. Everything is very, you know, dollar and corporate. So, me, I like the art side of it all.
The clientele right from the start, did you have like a nightclub clientele, a clubby? And were the fashions clubby then in the 70s?
In the 70s, yes. It moved on. It developed. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the beginning, it was the NYU campus. It was a certain aesthetic, let's say. And luckily, as I mentioned, NYU owned that building that I had my 8th Street shop in. So, you know, it was like, hi, Ray, how are you? I want to go to 8th Street. You have a store on 8th Street that goes downstairs. Is it available? And I knew it was available. But, you know, and that's how it all happened. It happened through NYU and a personal relationship with the real estate department and then moving over to 8th Street.
In the 1970s, did you go out? Did you go to like Max's Kansas City and CBGB's and Mud Club? Did you do all that? Studio 54?
Studio 54, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love jazz as well. A CBGB's, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aesthetically in that zone, rock and roll. I was more fashion jazz. But I used to go to McGregor's on St. Mark's.
Oh, the Ale House, yeah.
So he was a hairdresser. And that location turned into what is the Boy Bar.
Right.
And I used to go there.
That was also, wasn't it Warhol's club in the 60s?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not.
The Electric Circus, was that the space?
Was it Warhol's club? I know he came in my store once. Towards the end of my 8th Street store, it was, I believe. And he said, you're famous. I'm like, what? You're telling me I'm famous? I didn't say that, but I was like, a little floored.
Do you have specific memories of Studio 54 that you remember?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of memories of Studio 54. I used to go there. That was my go-to place. One time, there was this sort of, I don't know, poor or homeless or some kind of a person outside. And I said, you want to go in? He said, yeah. I took him in. Because I used to go there all the time. You know, they, at a certain point, they knew me. So that was a memory. But also, you know, the Paradise Garage with Larry Levan.
Of course.
I love that place. And I mention it in my book, that snowstorm that came into the garage. You go in there like, I don't know, 2 a.m. You go out there like at 8 a.m. And it was daytime.
I remember very well. You talk in your book about a place called the Sahara Club, which I had never heard of. And it sounds pretty interesting. Tell me about that.
Because you never heard of it because you're a man.
It's true.
And the Sahara Club was a lesbo bar uptown, 2nd Avenue and 62nd Street. And I became good friends with the owners of the bar. One of them passed recently and I felt really bad. She had a brain tumor or something. She lived in Miami with her girlfriend. At that time, that bar was, it was more chic, let's say. It had a different kind of a crowd. It wasn't that, in those days, that typical lesbo kind of person. I don't.
It was like for lipstick lesbians.
It was fashion. It was lipstick. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. And you had to be, it was sort of a little intimidating, probably. You had to be dressed. You had to be, yeah.
I suppose so, but I wasn't intimidated by it at all. I can pass.
That's good. Some of my favorite stories in the book are about some of the celebrities that come into the store. And famously, some of the store workers can be shady to the customers.
Yeah, the ones that really didn't have the good brain for, you know, how to deal. But then the shadiness kind of became part of the store.
The experience, yes.
Right. And it was never me. It was the little characters that I hired. Because they were fashionable and whatever. And yeah, it wasn't me. I was always, shut up. Stop that.
Tell me about when John Kennedy came with Carolyn Bessett.
I didn't even realize who he was, John Kennedy. I mean, she lived up the block in this very nice building that they had recently built at that time. And she was a client and she was... But he was kind of uncomfortable there, I think. And he was criticizing, you know, the cast of characters that worked there. I don't know. Usually when we caught a shoplifter, we would throw them out. He wasn't shoplifting. He was just criticizing. I'm like, out. I don't care who you are. I loved your father, but I don't love you.
So he had to stand outside while Carolyn was shopping?
Exactly.
Oh my God. And then one time Madonna came and she didn't know what time it opened and they made her wait outside for an hour or
yeah
something.
I wasn't there at that Madonna situation. But it was Cody Ravioli.
Of course it was Cody.
Right, you know, she's in the middle of all the whatever.
She was still up from the night before, bless her heart. I lived with her. I know these stories.
You know it.
Yes.
Yes. It was Cody.
So Madonna was standing outside for an hour while Cody was trying to get the store open.
I don't know. I wasn't actually there from the very beginning. It could have been part of the story that Cody made, put out there, let's say.
Uh-huh. It went through Nightlife. Yeah, everyone heard it at the clubs, how Cody made Madonna wait an hour.
Right. I wasn't present at that time in the store. So I only went by, you know, all the gab that came after it.
I love that you called it a volatile ecosystem of hierarchy that worked there. because you did, you always hire, I wonder even did in the 70s, were you hiring drag and trans and non-binary people? Was it always a conscious decision?
If you looked like you knew how you put yourself together, that was my criteria. Because I felt as though if you could put yourself together and you can, and you have a voice and you can talk to people, then you can put my customers together. And I always, my eye was always attracted to originality, original interpretations. And that was really what made me say hired or not hired. You know, I just feel like the people who worked in the store, it was important that they matched up with the aesthetics of the store. You know, they gave it their contribution, of course, being salespeople, but was atmosphere.
And I think they probably also influenced you to a certain degree and sort of changed the direction of the store sometimes because of their style.
Of course. A good example is I had a client from Thailand. He was a son of a wealthy Thailand person, and he got into voguing. And he was the one who opened up my eyes to the existence of voguing. It was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Because he was going to perform at a club in Harlem on the northern side of Central Park, the beginning of Harlem, in a brownstone somewhere. And he invited me to come, and I went. And that was my first experience in voguing and the Vogue balls and all of that, early 70s.
Oh, wow. It sort of seems like the salespeople, you did give them a lot of rope to do whatever they want. They could be as outrageous and crazy as you want, but you sort of kept them all on a leash at the same time. There was sort of maybe a push me, pull me thing where they could be crazy, but you were still always in charge, right?
Yes, but you know, I admired their, I mean, you could call it craziness, but I call it originality. Mm-hmm. And I also, what was also important is their ability to communicate with people who came in, you know. Armin Ra, for example, he's out there in L.A. now. He's very interesting.
He's a jewelry designer, a theremin expert. He's really a fascinating little kid.
I don't know where he found this instrument called the theremin, but whatever. And it was always used in sci-fi, kind of stuff. But he has a classical music background. And so somehow he created a hybrid with the theremin and the classical.
He's one of the leading theremin people in the world now, isn't he? He's one of
he performed
at Carnegie Hall. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing.
Even though he burnt my store down now.
But when he first came to the store, he was sort of run out of the store a little bit too, wasn't he? And then he ended up working there.
I don't remember that he was run out of the store, but maybe he was. I mean, he and I, what we have in common as well, we're both from Armenian background. Mm. And we had that bond, sort of. And I appreciated his aesthetics aside from that. But, you know, certain smaller countries, people are a little more clannish than a big country like USA, for example. And so people tend to take to each other. That's a very important thing. We don't, in our country, take to each other because we're American. Half the time we hate each other. But in smaller countries, you know, I'm half Greek, half Armenian, and I always bond, not exclusively only, but the door is open right away with Greeks or Armenians. And that's just because it's a smaller ethnic group and the people tend to be closer.
it's an extended family that you just, you sense right off the bat.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
That's a very good way to put it.
Let's talk a little bit about Rebecca Weinberg, Rebecca Field. You met her at Larry T's Love Machine.
Yes, on Union Square.
Yeah, and she was a go-go dancer, and she was the most beautiful, most fabulous go-go dancer I think we've ever seen. She was fabulous. Tell me about that first meeting.
I know somebody was tapping me on the shoulder, and I turned around to them, and they said, "Oh, she wants to talk to you." So I went over and said, "Hi, how are you?" And that's how that started. Actually, she's been in New York the last couple of weeks because she's styling, of course. It's a nice, you know, she worked on Sex and the City with me and back in the day. And
I follow her on Instagram. You know, it's always fun to see her. I always get a kick out of it. And
yeah, she has that personality that's, you know, very entertaining.
Yes. You were an it couple for 10 years, and you were a very volatile it couple. Every time we saw you, it was pow! It was, you know, you were always dressed. You looked fabulous. You were making the scene. My favorite memory is the Princess Deandra's House of Ecstasy ball at Red Zone. Tell us about that entrance and how it came about.
The theme of that ball was historical or something like that. And I said to Rebecca, who, you know, didn't care if she was naked in front of 1,000 people. And it was being held, this place was basically a garage on the west side, a big garage. And also over there is where a lot of the horses that take you around Central Park, the stables are there. So I knew that. And I said to Rebecca, "Lady Godiva naked on a horse. And of course she went for it.
And when that horse walked in the club with naked Rebecca on it, the kids fell out. It was absolutely hysterical. It was so good. People cheered on their feet, stomping. It was really great. But then you were judging, and what happened next?
I think I got into a fight with, well, there were a few different episodes at that ball. One was Angie Extravaganza with the hose with the big run in it, the black hose with the big run in it.
Okay. Well, first of all, so Mother Angie Extravaganza is the mother of the House of Extravaganza.
Exactly.
A legend. But she walked on stage with runs in her hose, and you were judging.
Walked down the runway with a big run in her black stocking, and I'm like, uh-oh.
So you topped Mother Angie Extravaganza.
Yeah, I chopped her. And then it was Princess Deandra's, I think it was her boyfriend at the time. And he did something to me, or I don't know, he said, and he really got my goat. And I had a cigarette in my hand. In those days you could smoke in the club. And I was like, and it turned into this whole ruckus because he was being like, so, you know, nasty to me. But he provoked me, and that was the end of that one.
And you stabbed him with your cigarettes?
Yeah.
Because I remember that, was it Deandra got on the microphone or something? And the House of Field is out. You must leave the club.
But that was her boyfriend.
Yes. And everyone was booing the House of Field, and you had to leave the club in shame.
We just left. I was not shamed. I'm like, I'm glad to be out of here. Bye.
Where was the horse during all of this?
Rebecca went was the first to go down the runway, so that her part was done. And then came Angie Extravaganza with the run in her black stocking. Everything, I got to say, everything is so bland these days. I'm glad that I lived through more expressive days, because it's the way people dress, the way they entertain themselves, the whole business. It's just like, ooh.
Why do you think that is? Do you think people edit themselves? Do you think social media has a lot to do with that? Why do you think the world is so bland?
Well, I think it's not just one reason. I believe that, okay, art, whether it's painting or any form of art, poetry, so on, what it offers to the people is that it gives them a place in that time, how people felt, if they were happy, if it was positive time. And I did mention it in my book. After World War I was over, and there was an elevation, and all of a sudden those long dresses came above the knee, and people were doing the Charleston. And, you know, it's an expression of how they feel. And they feel good or they don't feel good or whatever. And I think today, I think it's kind of that blah time. It doesn't seem to be as inspired as it could be. So that's why there's you guys, there's me. And, you know, we have that in us, but it's all the same. It's not, there's the individuality part is taking a nap. But I hope to see it come back. Little by little, I see some things.
I have a feeling that you probably hate the stealth wealth, rich look that's every, you know, that they talk about like on Succession with all the boring, you know, bland cashmere. All this boring fashion must sort of drive you a little bananas right now.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'm more about expression. You create your own presentation by using your taste and what catches your eye and how you put it together. You know, copying is not that interesting. I've seen it before.
I saw you on a TikTok recently talking about personal style. And you were saying that there's so much more to personal style, that it's about how you live and the friends that you have. And
right. The clothes are just a part of it. Your personal style, as I think of it, your personal philosophy, whether it touches on what your taste in books are or your home. I mean, it's the same thing with home furnishings today. You look at these magazines, it's all the same. I would love you to come to my apartment in New York when you're here, and I'll show off my Turkish lamps that I bought in Istanbul and, you know, all the personal, interesting things that I have found in my life. Mm-hmm. It's personal. And I think it's really, people rob themselves when they follow some kind of trend, because they're not trained to, like, maybe have confidence in their own taste, or I'm not sure what. When people do not feel happy the way, when people feel happy, they express it. When they're not happy, they express it. They don't know they're not happy. They think it's all fine, but it's boring, and they're expressing it. And, you know, I want people to enjoy their lives. Make it meaningful. It's very important. Enjoy it.
But sort of what I get from that is that, like, can style be taught? And I think it's probably just, it's about finding happiness in your life and then expressing it through
style.
Yeah. So style can be taught, you think, or are you just born with it?
You're not born with style.
No.
You're born naked. You don't have style when you're born.
And the rest is style.
The rest is style.
Yes, the rest is style. What you come across in your early life and your life contributes to your own personal style. I mean, I felt kind of fortunate that my mom was in that business. She'd say, Pat, this is silk. You have to use something organic to take this stain out. You know, a synthetic chemical is no good. I was like, oh, cool. Let's buy a townhouse up the street. No, we can't afford it. I said, why? How much does it cost? Oh, probably about $40,000. I'm talking about the Upper East Side. I was like, oh, I want a townhouse.
I did want to just go back to the House of Field a little bit more because, you know, Suzanne did the love balls, but you started the downtown balls for charity, didn't you? The ball on Grand Street that you did in 88, was it?
I don't remember the date, but 88?
I think so.
You know what? I was so inspired by the voguing balls. So it led me into making a House of Field, which was kind of a fashion house. I copied it, but it was I copied something really good.
I remember that because Andre Leon Talley and Diane Brill and Malcolm McLaren and Mary McFadden, you brought in a lot of fashion people to be judges. And the fashion community was meeting the voguing community for the first time. I remember Veronica Webb walking face and the kids just went, you know, berserk.
Do you remember Myra, who was like the mistress of ceremonies? And there was some issue that she had. Oh, I know. With Suzanne Bartsch.
Yes.
Because I said to Suzanne, get a table. My kids are coming, but we don't need a table. And they were all in the front of the stage. And Myra, who was like one of my right hands at that point, and who I still see, was getting letters from the audience that they couldn't see because all these people were in front of the stage.
It was all the Suzanne Bartsch crowd, yes.
Yeah. And so Myra let them have it because nothing stopped Myra, if you remember her.
And Myra threw the Bartsch crowd out, and that was another scandal.
Right, right, right.
She said, out. I remember because Princess Myra was a strong personality. And
exactly.
She took that microphone and she did not. It was 6 hours that she was on stage and she had all of Manhattan in her hand for six
yes.
hours. And she was yelling at people and you are out.
Yeah, that was her personality. I still see Myra. She's the mother of three young ladies,
uh-huh.
The wife of a pathologist.
Wow.
You know what I mean? It's like, and I always remember her, that she told me, her mother wanted her to be a doctor. But, you know, she was this wild girl.
She was wild.
Oh, yes. I could tell you, but I wouldn't. And well, her husband's sweetheart. Perfect for Myra, because Myra's, you know. Anyway, she told him, get away from the stage. Nobody can see. Go sit down. And she told Suzanne, you were offered a table, and you said you didn't need it. But you need it.
Yelling at her on stage in front of everybody.
You know, by the way, as far as Myra's concerned, she has a documentary called Love is in the Legend about the Grand Street Ball.
Oh, you caught it all on camera.
I don't know if you're interested, but.
Oh, wow. I just wanted to say that there was the House of Field Ball at the Roxy one time, and I won the category of master and servant, where Keoki was dressed as a dog. He was a leather dog and he had me on a leash and I had a bone in my mouth and was walking down the runway on all fours and he was whipping me and the crowd went bananas and I still have my trophy somewhere from the House of Fields ball. It is one of my proudest moments.
You deserve to win it.
Yes, I won it. When the servant becomes the master because the dog was walking the person. Let's go to Sex and the City real quick, because so much of that is just, you know, it's the story of the clothes. To me, I just watch it for your outfits. I really do. But
No, but I really want to say one thing about that. Yes, I played a big role in it, but working with Sarah Jessica Parker, she got it immediately. We had fun together. It was like we were playing a game together. And believe me, her input, it was very important to the look.
Well, you started so many trends, and there were so many fashion moments that came out of the show and everything. But was there ever an outfit that was too much for Sarah? Was there ever anything where she put her foot down and said no?
Well, I have to say, I never remember a foot being put down. However, it was very rare. You know, the idea of the flower, she came with that idea. It was very, what would you call it, cooperative? It was very...
collaborative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Together, you know, we built that character. It was fun with Sarah Jessica making Carrie, because Sarah Jessica understood fashion. Mm-hmm. She really got it. So it was really good to work.
And you had worked with her before on Miami Rhapsody, right?
I did. I worked with Sarah Jessica with Miami Rhapsody. Actually, she brought me into Sex and the City.
Mm.
Because they had made a pilot and nobody liked it. I don't know anything about it. And I didn't want to get involved in it. You know, whoever the designer was and all that stuff. And Sarah Jessica brought me in to meet Darren Star. And it worked out well. For the opening credits, when we shot that little tulle skirt.
Iconic.
I found it in a basket in a showroom. I pulled it out, $5. I'm like, perfect. I know she'll love it. Because she had her twists in fashion. And I got it, and we got it together. And it worked out. It really did.
You know, when I think of my favorite outfits from the show, it's the tutu in the opening that always stands out. I think it's the Alexander McQueen in the wedding dress in the movie.
Wasn't it Vivian Westwood?
Yes.
Oh, it was Vivian Westwood. Yes, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Similarly, with Devil Wears Prada, was there ever a moment with Meryl where she said, no, that's too much?
You know, I have to say no. Meryl was Meryl and Sarah Jessica, and they're both very different. And when David Frankel, who was the director who I worked with before, came to me about Devil Wears Prada, and he said the word Meryl Streep, I go, yes. But also, David, we have a really wonderful history together. And I sat down with Meryl and her, you know, right hand, and they told me she was going to do her hair white. I always wanted to dress Meryl because she can play any role, but a lot of the roles she plays, it's kind of like folksy or something. I don't know what, Plain Jane, I don't know. And I was like, ooh, I'd like to get my hands on Meryl. And sure enough, it happened. And she looked great. I was really happy with the way she looked and for that role. I was really surprised. I got an Academy Award nomination for the clothes. But my favorite designer, Melina Cananero, she was sitting right behind me, and she did Marie Antoinette.
Oh, right, the Sofia Coppola, yeah.
She won, but I was glad because I really respect her. Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't have to win it. She deserved it.
I think in another year you would have gotten it, definitely. But it's hard to beat those, you know, 18th century clothes.
I know, and that's not my cup of tea.
Right.
I'm not a fashion historian. I'm more into the future. But I really do respect Melina Cananero, trust me. I'm always, whenever I see that she's doing something, I make it a point to try and see it.
I was curious, just this, a little bit of an aside, but, you know, you've been, historically, you've been a supporter of so many independent and young designers. And I just thought this might be a nice opportunity to share the names of some, because I think it's always nice to kind of spread the word, and I'm not necessarily young, but just like more independent designers who are doing their thing and making fresh stuff. And you've been, you know, such a huge supporter for so long.
Yeah, well, that's what keeps me interested in doing it. In my gallery here, I invited a handful of designers that were in my shop on Bowery. I invited them to participate. And I mean, I would love to show you some different designers. However, I know we have our limitations and, you know, but I'm very happy here. A Scooter La Forge is one of the designers.
Love Scooter.
And he's really great. A Dope Tavio, as you mentioned.
Stud Muffin.
Oh, Stud Muffin, definitely. Jody Morlock, who started out in my 8th Street store way back when. She's from Miami. She worked in my 8th Street store for years. And then she became the hairdresser. Ah, yes.
I have a Jody Morlock bag right here.
There you go. Oh, thank you. I'll tell her that. I want her to know that.
Yes, I love it. I love all her. I was going to get a tote bag of hers this week, too, for DragCon.
Yeah. I love her bags. Her bags have been great lately. She got into the bag thing, which I thought was a really good move for her. And she always comes and does my hair and makeup when I have an event. It's cool.
For 30 years, 40 years or more, that you have always been supporting the drag community, the club kid community, non-binary trans.
I don't know the new language, by the way.
Well, but you've just been there and you've given people jobs and you've always been, you know, you've helped them. And I wonder what you think about this sort of the demonization of drag queens and trans violence on the rise. And the
you know my answer. It's ridiculous. But we're in a very dark time now between, excuse me, Mr. Trump, excuse me, Mr. Florida Governor. None of it is happy to me. There's no happiness in any of it. And I don't believe in wasting my life's time on things that don't give me pleasure. And I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't know who gets it. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't like violence. I don't like any of that. I like brains. I like talking to one another, understanding one another. I'm not from that world of, you know, I'm better than you and all that. We're all here together. Let's enjoy each other.
It is weird because, you know, the 80s could be very dark, you know, with the AIDS crisis and there was politics and everything. But I don't remember it ever being as scary as it is now. I'm very worried about this generation.
I know. I don't know if it's, is it a generation? Is it, I don't know. These guys that are like storming the Capitol and beating on people. This is like, and they're threatening a civil war. I mean, what the hell is going on here? You live in fucking America, one of the best places to live, and you're acting like a bunch of idiots. Get smart, boys and girls.
Yeah.
It just shows, in my mind, the lack of education. You know, remember I said I studied political science, government, I studied philosophy. So, you know, I have all those seeds in my brain. And when I watch these things, these seeds are sprouting buds. I mean, you're here for a short period of time. Enjoy it. Make it positive. Offer something to your fellow man. But, you know, the ringleader is the ringleader. I don't have to say his name. Yeah. The rape artist.
No. So what is next for Pat? What is the next adventure?
Well, I just released my book.
Yeah, congratulations.
I mean, I surprise myself. People like it. I like it. But the people like it, I like it the most. And I am venturing upon a documentary that will be playing in New York. I would love to get it in L.A. The director and producer are from L.A., and I'll put them in touch with you guys, you know, if it's helpful, if it's interesting for you.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's really funny because the director said to me at the very beginning, well, Pat, what do you do for exercise? And I say, I like to swim. So they found me a pool in Chelsea. Very nice. And it opens up the documentary. I'm in the pool swimming. It was winter. I went outside. I was freezing. So, you know, I think it's okay. I saw a screening of it. It's very, very hard to look at yourself. But people said it's okay. So I trust them. It was a different feeling with the book. I wasn't looking at myself. I was maybe writing about myself, sending my co-writer to interviews, to interview people. It wasn't, but when I looked at myself on this documentary, I'm like, ooh. But I guess it was okay. It was just personal.
I think it's the difference between like self-reflection and you're doing it, you know, alone or with someone and you're just, you're in a room writing as opposed to having other people talk about you and having to see yourself 20 feet tall. It's a jarring experience, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But I think it worked out, actually. I think it looks good. And I'm anticipating the premiere of it.
Well, Pat, it's been so nice catching up with you. Thank you so much. I'm so glad we were able to work this out. I love you so much.
Icon.
Icon forever.
Yeah, maybe an icon, but a real dummy with this computer. Thank God for my, I don't even want to call her an assistant, but without her, I would be dead.
Well, shout out to Erica, who helped set this up.
Yeah, Erica.
Come, Erica, say, give them a hi. Come on.
Give us a hi.
Hi.
Hi, Erica. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you guys.
Thank you.
I never got a chance to meet you around my gallery, but I'm sitting in it, and maybe in the future we'll do episode 2, The Gallery.
Perfect.
Okay.